wait just a minute and let everyone get settled. Okay, Mr. Beard.
Thank you, Judge Smith. May it please the court, counsel. James Clark is before the court today on appeal of his conviction of the importation of alien for immoral purpose statute. And I think that simply reading the title aloud begs the question, what does immoral purpose mean? And that is ultimately the question before the court today. Clark raised three specific points on appeal. But I want to emphasize that I think that the larger theme or scope of the case today for the court is that the government has essentially increased the ambiguity surrounding an already vague statute by unilaterally broadening the scope of the immoral purpose clause. Now, the threshold objection that was made below by way of a dismissal motion was whether or not the statute itself is vague. And I won't belabor the point right now. I understand under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, I imagine that the court will look at other issues first and perhaps not reach the constitutional question. But I point out that the strength of the argument here isn't because we say it's vague. It's because Congress itself has looked at identical language in an analog statute, the White Slave Trade Statute, the Mann Act. And in 1986, removed the immoral purpose language precisely, it said, in the legislative history, because that language was vague and because it was capable of criminalizing.
But the statute as applied to this individual, that argument would be, was not vague, and there is no jus tertiae standing in a due process, unlike facial attacks on the First Amendment. So that if it's correct as applied to this defendant, where are you?
Judge, you can bother.
In other words, you've got our immoral purposes, which are, let's assume for the moment that in and of it, if that's all you had, it would be vague. But the threshold question, was this defendant put on notice for the charges against him? And that the other aspects of the case make it quite clear to me that he had notice. Now, whether that's he did notice or that he was somehow or another convicted on a charge that the jury might have found some other kind of purpose, is that, so I'm not clear whether you're going with that argument.
Well, let me say this. I don't think that he was on notice. The indictment does charge, and it uses the language right out of the statute, which mentions prostitution and or other immoral purposes. But, of course, that begs the question.
Well, I don't say it, but it charges. He's on notice that they brought a woman in for prostitution, correct?
He was on notice. That was the government's theory, yes.
Well,
yes, Your Honor.
I understand. Well, we're talking about just a notice in the indictment. That's all. But he had notice of that, right?
Yes.
And so my question to you is that, and it said, are the immoral purpose? Now, if the whole case is tried on the theory of, let me ask you this, what other immoral purposes were, you said it's vague and unknown, but what other suggested conduct was it at trial other than the purposes of prostitution?
I'm happy to go into that right now because that goes to the instructions. What this case was tried on was
I'm trying to get to is that it sounds like an instruction problem, if any, then that's where this problem will emerge. Am I wrong about that?
I think that the problem with the way that the case was tried is that it was tried on a theory of sexual exploitation. The government asked for and received an instruction that that immoral purpose included sexual exploitation and apparently other things as well because it said it included. And sexual exploitation itself was then defined as basically how someone is treated. It said to use a person unjustly for one's advantage in a manner associated with or related to sex. And I think that the what went on below, and in fact I don't think it, I'm quite confident that the record will establish this, is that the government then introduced all sorts of evidence concerning whether Mr. Clark had pictures of naked women on his computer, whether or not he had actually been in contact with other people in Africa, whether he had committed bad acts in this country, matters that were completely unrelated to the offense charged. And basically, because of the incredibly broad instruction that the jury had in front of it, it was able to convict, if it so chose, on factual determinations that it made far, far away, far askance from what the actual charging statute was, which is to look at whether or not, at a given point in time, Clark had an intent to import women for prostitution. And I think part of the awkwardness in this particular case is we're dealing with statutes that were placed on the books 100, 110 years ago in response to historical circumstances that, there may have been issues then. I'm not so much sure there are now. The statutes are still on the book, and I'm not suggesting that the government can't take them off the shelf if they want to and use them. But I would ask that the court take notice of the Mann Act, which is set at 18 U.S.C. 2421, 2422, because these are the statutes that the Congress has most recently used to identify, to criminalize the exact behavior. And they have moved away from this broad notion of immoral purpose. For that matter, I'd also point out, in terms of notice, of course, there is the Biddy case the Supreme Court decided in 1910 that talked about what prostitution was. And I would also point out to the court that the term that was used, the definition of prostitution that was used then, far, far different what's commonly understood now.
Well, let me go back to the question of sexual exploitation. I thought that the government's theory here was the way the case was argued, as I read the closing arguments and a little bit of the record excerpts, I guess, it may be misleading, was that this was not consensual sex, and it's not exploitation in the sense that he brought here to have a sex partner, but it was coercive. That it was a virtually rape, in that he had extraordinary power over her and threatened to ship her back. And when she packed her clothes overnight, thinking she was going to be shipped back, and et cetera, that's an enormous amount of leverage. And so that was, the argument that was made. I'm just saying, if that's so, then there was a permissible base for the jury to act. Now, I understand you have said that the jury might have gone in some other theory, but I wanted to first find out if there is a permissible base in this prosecution or not, although there may be other impermissible bases.
To the extent you've just asked me whether or not sexual exploitation was a permissible base, my response is no, it's not. And I would point out that the instruction that was sought after and received had no basis in law. I know the government will likely point the court's attention to the unpublished opinion by this court in Wisenhunt, but this court never said that sexual exploitation was in fact a permissible basis. And I'd also point out in the most recent 28J letter that we submitted that the Sentencing Commission, even when it was looking at what sexual exploitation is, never referred to this particular statute. So, no, I don't think that was a particular basis at all, and I think that's you've just underscored what the gravamen of the problem here is, because the case went forward to the jury on an incredibly vast playing field, if you will, at least for the government's advantage. They were able to bring up anything that looked, as you just said, coercive. But I don't know that coercion is in the same class of offenses as prostitution, as the statute itself currently reads.
Counsel, let me ask you that, as you have pointed out, Judge Higginbotham, there are really at least two possible problems here. One is the statute itself. One is the instruction. The instruction certainly tried to hone in on certain aspects of what might be in moral purposes, and to use the word exploitation, which is then defined in a fairly broad way, as you have indicated. But in the 28J letter, when you're talking about sexual exploitation or exploitation more generally, it is clear that the guidelines recognize exploitation as a reason to enhance sentences, and the key is not some prohibition of exploitation as a consideration, but that a jury be properly guided, it seems to me, on what exploitation means. So where is If we get beyond the vagueness of the statute and actually just look at this instruction, what is the key problem in your mind in the instruction? I mean, you said broad and whatever else. It seems to me that is there any particular word in that instruction that you think takes the jury down the wrong path?
Yeah, yes, I do. I here's what I think. I think, first of all, that immoral purpose should have been defined as the language, borrow the language from the Mann Act. Because what the Mann Act does is it basically takes out the term immoral purpose and says any sexual activity for which any person can be charged with a criminal offense. And that, I think, adds a specificity. The government can come forward and say, if, for example, as Judge Higginbotham said, you were acting coercively under 2422 or what have you, it provides guidance, if you will, on what exactly the individual is charged with doing. Because simply and I want to make sure I've answered your question, Judge Sullivan, I think immoral purpose itself is a problem. I think it could have been defined in conjunction with what Congress has since done, looking at the identical language in an analogous context. And that would have set the case on the right path. Alternatively, I suppose, you could have simply, the case could have been tried as prostitution and then prostitution defined. It's important to understand that the definition of prostitution that was given effect in the Biddy case is no longer prostitution as we understand it today. At that time, any type of sexual activity that took place outside of marriage was considered prostitution. I think that we'd have a hard time with that today. So there were things that could have been done below.
Let's look at the definition itself, and I may have cut you off on the verge of getting to it, but that's really what my question is. To use a person unjustly for one's advantage in a matter associated with sex, where does that go astray in your mind?
Because we have no...
Where? What point? What is there a way to make that instruction work by changing a word or two?
I think the problem with it is the unjustly. We don't know. A juror could be sitting thinking, was it something that took place in Africa? Was it something that took place here? Was it something that was said or not done? There's no way of knowing what the criminality is. I think the problem is unjustly.
But with regard to instructional error, focus on that for a moment. Our inquiry is not the abstract reading of that statute. We've said repeatedly in Shager and a whole host of cases, and it's really how the case was tried. And the Supreme Court has demonstrated repeatedly. And if you read this thing, this fellow was not tried on the basis of consensual sex. He was tried on the basis of sexual exploitation. And what we're saying that this guy's guilty of is he coerced this woman and so forth. And if that's the case, then what do you say to the argument insofar as instructional error? Why is that? Why is not the total message that's given to that jury made clear by the way the case is tried insofar as sexual exploitation is concerned? What's the answer?
I think if you accept the premise that it was appropriate to instruct on sexual exploitation and whatever that is, in this very broad sense, whatever that is, then as I understand your question, I don't know that there was anything improper, but that begs one of the things we're saying. It wasn't
I'm
proper.
Not asking to accept it. I'm saying where is the error? If the way the case is tried is on sexual coercion, because what he's been tried for is coercing this woman, and that's where the case was tried, and the question becomes then, so it may have some other vaguer applications in the abstract, but this was not vague in the courtroom, and that's what we're trying to seek here.
If it was tried on a theory of coercion.
Yes.
Then coercion falls outside the under the Biddy opinion, outside of what prostitution is, and so we're back to what Biddy said the statute meant. Grantedly, you know, over 100 years ago.
I just follow what you said. I thought you said earlier that the in response to Judge Southwick's question that what they should have done was to have charged the Mann Act, which was to put that language in there. And what they did put in there actually was exploitation. I'm saying that if the exploitation as tried is, if they had it put in the indictment that he transported him in order to gain leverage and to coerce her into a sexual relationship, then I think you would agree that that would be an adequate charge.
Well, I think that the term sexual exploitation without more, even under the Mann Act, you're having to charge a particular crime.
Let me ask the question again.
All right, then.
I thought you said that the Mann Act language, it would have been proper, and that it would have been adequate here, and what the government should have done was to charge them with having brought her here that, into the United States for the purpose of coercing her, it's a criminal offense, into sexual relationships. Would that be adequate?
It's accurate that they could have charged under the Mann Act. Yes, Your Honor.
My question is, would that have been sufficient to charge her with brought here for the purpose of coercing her into sex?
Not under this statute. Under the statute charged, I think the government would go well afar, and I think they did do that below.
All right, your initial time has expired, Mr. Beard.
Thank you.
Time for rebuttal. Ms.
Yes.
Allington?
May it please the court. The prosecution spelled out its theory of sexual exploitation very, very clearly at trial. It began in opening statements when the prosecutor said, "This is a case about human trafficking, a case about a promised scholarship with no strings, which Clark transformed into a loan when the victim refused Clark's frequent and persistent demands for sex. A loan that must be repaid with sexual acquiescence on demand at the threat of being deported from the United States and sent back to her home country. A requirement that she prostitute herself for him in repayment of a debt, quid pro quo." And again at closing, he reiterated, "Clark brought these women, or was intending to bring these women over, because it wasn't just Ms. Najow. The evidence shows clearly that it was like a factory line of women he was preparing to bring over. He was bringing them over to victimize them, to use them, to exploit them sexually." In this respect, this case is very similar to United States versus Wolf, which the defense relies on in its reply. But what the defense does not mention about United States versus Wolf, which is a Seventh Circuit case in which Judge Posner wrote the majority opinion, is that Judge Posner stated very clearly, and this is in 1986, so not too far from the present, not back in 1910, right after the statute was written, he said, "While sexual standards in this country have changed over the last 100 years, and while transporting someone for the purpose of concubinage or to become a mistress would probably not fall within the statute in these days, bringing women over for Wolf," I should mention, was a case with almost identical facts to this case. In that case, it was refugee women that a defendant was targeting and bringing to his home and having them stay in an apartment over his garage and sexually harassing them and at one point raping one of them. And Posner said, "But regardless of what you think about whether concubinage or becoming a mistress is, exploiting these vulnerable refugee women is clearly an immoral purpose." Here the prosecution was trying to take the statute back to its roots. Mr. Beard said that the government was trying to expand the statute, but that's exactly opposite to what the government was doing here. Of course, we're all aware of Biddy and its progeny and how the Supreme Court expanded the statute past its roots. And included within that the language of other immoral purpose, certain things that we can quibble about now, whether they still would fall within them. But the core of this statute, and there was a core, we know that from the legislative history and from the text of the statute itself, was to prevent the exact thing that happened here, forced prostitution, sexual exploitation of an especially vulnerable victim, someone from overseas, someone from a poor country who had no means of providing for herself and who was totally dependent upon the man who brought her over. And that's exactly what was shown during trial, and that's exactly what the jury found Mr. Clark guilty of.
Counsel, even if most of what you said until the very end we accept, speak to whether this instruction actually required the jurors to make that kind of evaluation. How does focusing, again, we're looking at criminal conduct, how does focusing on whether a person has unjustly, there's kind of gets into one's cosmic sense of justice, taking advantage. There are a lot of non-criminal taking advantages. And then the subject matter has to be sex. And this doesn't even sound necessarily like a crime in the way that you've defined it, though the facts may well very clearly have shown a crime. Isn't that a problem here?
It is not a problem, Your Honor, because the jury instructions were, as Judge Higginbotham had mentioned before when he mentioned Chagra, the case where this court has instructed that you have to read the jury instructions in light of the counsel's arguments, in the light of the overall theory presented at trial. The theory was very narrow. I concede that it is hard to define sexual exploitation and package it in a very tight definition, but it can be circumscribed based on the facts and the theory at trial. And the government
counsel, weren't the facts very much disputed, his motivations when he engaged in any kind of sexual conduct with the victim? I mean, it seems to me with this sort of, it's one thing to say the facts of the case must be the context for understanding whether an instruction is proper or not, but there are different facts in this case. And a very general instruction allows a jury not to have to decide which set of facts to accept. And that seems, I mean, weren't there disputed facts here about what he did and when he did it and what his motivations were and what her consent was? And doesn't this instruction override all of those differences?
There was, the evidence was really, there were doubts cast upon the evidence in defense counsel's statements. There really was not a lot of contrary evidence to what the government put forward. On appeal, the defense would have you believe that it was really contested why he brought her over here. Was it for a consensual relationship? Was it just so he could, you know, start up some sort of thing with her that could have been consensual? But if you look at the testimony, that was not just her testimony, but of the other people who testified, and especially the documentary evidence and the transcript of the call that she tape recorded where he said, I brought you over to show your ASS to me. I will let you stay if you have sex with me and with my friends. Otherwise, you're out of here. That was incontrovertible evidence that the government submitted. So the government would argue that no, the evidence was really not contradictory on that point. And while the defense tried to cast doubt on, really the defense at trial focused solely on making Ms. Najal look like an opportunist, and maybe she was incredible, but there was corroboration of her statements at practically every juncture. There was, and I was going to talk about this too when I talked about the evidence supporting the prostitution prong of the statute. So I'll go ahead and go into that now.
Well, was issue joined on whether or not it was consensual sex or not, or?
It was, yes, there was nothing to show that the sexual contact they engaged in was consensual once she came over to the United States. Really, the only question I think that could have been in anyone's mind was it consensual, any of the things they engaged in when she was still in Kenya for that one first encounter? But she explained very credibly at trial that she was really confused during that first encounter. He had said he was a minister, his church had a scholarship program. Can she come upstairs with him to exchange contact information? When she gets up there, all of a sudden, can you take off your clothes and take a shower? Can you sit on the bed naked while I fondle you? Can we sit, go under the covers and watch a movie together while you're naked? Can I take a picture of your genitalia to remember you by? That really could have been the only point with the jury had any question, but I don't know if she was consenting or not because she was a prostitute at that time. But once she got to the United States, it was piece of evidence after piece of evidence. Her testimony was backed up by these emails saying, I'm going to pick you up at 2 and return you at 7. But she said he meant to pick me up to have sex. There was an email from her saying, I don't want to have sex with you. I have sex with you because I'm afraid I'm going to be deported. There were emails from him saying, you are a prostitute and you liked it when you were over there. I don't know why you're so high and mighty now. You're trying to refuse it, but you know, you were doing it for money. What's so different about now? So the attacks on the evidence now really are, they cannot succeed because her testimony is corroborated. But I did want to mention, the defense would have you believe this statute is says that someone can't import an alien for immoral purposes. That's not what the statute said. We would have a bigger problem if that's what the statute said. But the statute says a defendant can't import an alien for prostitution or any other immoral purposes. Prostitution is a very important word, not just because you can base a conviction just on prostitution itself, but also because it limits the rest of what the statute means. And it was expanded in Biddy and in that old line of cases, but it still is important because even if we forget all those cases that expanded it to polygamy and concubinage, it circumscribes what a theory could be under which the prosecution proceeded in this case. And it also differentiates this statute from the statutes in City of Chicago versus Morales and in Colander versus Lawson, which were very vague and provided and had no word like prostitution, no solid word to limit the expanse of the statute. This court, as important as this analysis is, and this argument about the constitutionality of the statute, of that prong of the statute and instructions, the easiest way to affirm this conviction is to hold that the evidence was sufficient to show that Clark imported Ms. Najal for the purpose of prostitution. As has been mentioned several times, the government proceeded under two theories. The evidence was related as to both theories, but they were two separate theories. And the Supreme Court has recently held that when a jury is instructed on multiple theories of guilt, and one of the theories is later held to be invalid, the court can still affirm if there is sufficient evidence on the valid theory. And here, there was sufficient evidence that Clark imported Ms. Najal for the purpose of prostitution. That evidence started the day he met her in Nairobi, where he asked her, as I previously said, to come up to his room, and he did many things with her that suggested that he saw her as nothing more than a prostitute. And he also asked her, and along with the other things I mentioned that he did, with where she had no clothes on and there was fondling involved, he took a picture of her genitalia, and he also gave her $100 at the end of the encounter and said, go get an STD test. Why would he want her to do this if he wasn't planning on engaging with sexual contact of the same sort in a future occasion? Well, in fact, the day she arrived in Texas, he did just that. He forced her, basically, or coerced her into having another sexual encounter with her, and he used words that suggested that he expected this from her, not because he saw her as a girlfriend or a future wife, but because he thought she was an object that was meant to give him sexual gratification, and he had expended all this money on her, so it was time for her to give back. So they had that first sexual encounter in America, which was very hostile and very abusive. And 48 hours after that, he took her to a clinic in Lubbock for another STD test. And we have record evidence of that STD test. And he filled out part of the paperwork for that, and he identified himself as her uncle, which also suggests that he was not seeing himself as a boyfriend or a future husband, but as someone who was trying to hide the nature of his relationship with her. After that encounter, she testified at trial that he demanded sex from her basically every day, and he would show up to her dorm unannounced, and we have a witness, objective witness, the dean of students at the college, who said, I saw him walk right into her dorm, and I thought, what is he doing? And he seemed to know exactly where he was going. We stopped him. We said, you can't just march into a girl's dorm. And he said, oh, whoops, I'm sorry. And they said, she's not even here. And he said, oh, that means she's in the technology center. This was a man who was keeping surveillance over his prize that he had imported from Africa. And then he has emails that say, as I mentioned before, I'm going to come at 2, I'll bring you back at 6 or 7. He has emails saying, I don't know why you won't have sex now, you did it fine, you know, when you were in Kenya, when you had to, when you were a prostitute. And then last, we have the very damning telephone conversation where He says, you want to stay in America, you have sex with me and my friends, and I'll let you stay. All of that evidence is overwhelming on the point, on the government's theory that he imported her for the purpose of prostitution. And this court's finding that evidence is sufficient on that theory would basically circumvent all of the analysis on whether the other prong of the statute, the other moral purposes prong, is constitutional. I would also circumvent the jury instruction issue because they are not raising any objection to the jury instructions on prostitution, only on the other moral purpose prong. And then lastly, it would circumvent the issue on the evidence that was admitted about Mr. Clark previously having shot or almost shot someone, because a finding that the evidence was overwhelming on that point means that the evidence there was harmless.
What do you do with the defendant's heavy reliance on the Lawrence decision?
The Lawrence decision would only come into play if this were a case where a man was charged and prosecuted for bringing a woman over for a consensual sexual relationship. Then the Lawrence line of cases, yes, would directly impact that, because the right to privacy would be at issue, and it would basically be a duel between two sets of Supreme Court precedent. And I'm sure the Lawrence line of cases would probably win, because that's, you know, the more recent precedent. I did want to mention that Lawrence itself, though, he relies so much on Lawrence, but Lawrence was very careful to distinguish exactly the type of right to privacy that was at issue. And the court said there, the present case does not involve minors. It does not involve persons who might be injured or coerced, or who are situated in relationships where consent might not be easily refused. It does not involve public conduct or prostitution. This case involves exactly that. So there is no right to privacy implicated on the facts of this case. There might be on some future hypothetical prosecution that has never come to pass in the last 80 years or so, and that is not likely to, given that the government rarely uses this statute. And when it does so, as is evidenced by this case, it's very narrowly circumscribed and goes back to the core of what the statute was designed to prevent.
Let me ask you a question about Biddy. The court there defined the phrase immoral purpose in 1328 as of being the same general class or kind of the peculiar purpose of prostitution. And that particular narrowing of the that statute remained in effect, and the Congress later amended it to say, the Mann Act to say, make that more precise, to say not of the same general class, but of a criminal offense. Is Biddy good law or not?
I think Biddy construes...
Just an itty-bitty question.
I'll give you an itty-bitty answer. I think Biddy construes the clause too broadly. I think it would fall to a Lawrence-type challenge under the right facts, which I don't think will ever come to pass, because I don't think the government will ever pursue bias. That's my employer. I don't think they would pursue that type of prosecution. But yes, I think it would fall. And I think that's what the defense is trying to have you decide right now, and this is just not the proper vehicle for that, because these are not the facts of the case. I wanted to mention one more thing about the Mann Act. The defense keeps saying over and over that the Mann Act had identical language to 1328. That's actually not true. The Mann Act criminalized bringing a woman over for the purpose of prostitution, debauchery, or other immoral purposes. Debauchery is a very wide, big term.
That's no longer immoral, I guess.
Well, it depends. I think it depends. But right, in a Tanasaw versus United States, a 1917 case, the Supreme Court held that transporting a girl across state lines to become a chorus girl was a purpose that fell within debauchery. And I definitely don't think that precedent would stand today. And that's probably part of why the Mann Act was amended and 1328 was left intact. Also, the Mann Act was not gender neutral in 1986. And Congress, that was really the primary purpose, if you look at the legislative history, for why the Mann Act was amended. 1328, however, was gender neutral. There was a previous amendment to that statute in 1952 that made it gender neutral. The defense would have you believe that Congress just forgot about 1328 when it amended the Mann Act, but these are two reasons why Congress was focused on the Mann Act and not 1328. Congress did amend the Mann Act one more, or did amend 1328 one more time in 1990. That was a very superficial change, but it shows that Congress still knew this statute was on the books. The government is entitled to use this statute, and it did so properly in this case. There are no more questions. I yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Simonson. Mr. Beard, you save time for rebuttal.
Counsel is absolutely correct that I left out debauchery. We were focusing on the immoral purpose language in the Mann Act, and I apologize to the court about that. The core protection of this statute is not to guard against the degradation of women, however admirable that would, of course, be. It was the protection of marriage. And so in response to your question, is Biddy good law? Biddy is still on the books. Much has changed, and we'll see how this shakes out. This case.
Well, but if prostitution or other, the Supreme Court read that, or the other language be, or of other conduct of that type, that is a substantial narrowing of to what is a genre of, by a court, of narrowing that to what Congress essentially later said of criminal conduct, not simply. And I don't think I don't think you're arguing that prostitution has gained any more acceptance of it's not acceptable moral conduct.
I tend to think that it was a narrowing, and then in light of what the Congress did in 1986 with removing immoral purpose and adding in language about crimes that sexual activity for which any person can be charged, I do tend to think it narrows it and tries to remove that, but I don't think that's what happened here. And earlier when you were questioning me, you made a point of asking about how the case was tried. I understand why the government wants to suggest that this was tried as a prostitution case. It was not tried as a prostitution case. I would submit to you that the record is very, very...
No, I wasn't suggesting that. What I was suggesting to you, the narrowing instruction is to confine the offense, chargeable offense, to conduct of the same type as prostitution, which would mean some illegal, not something that is of the same class of illegal act. And coercive conduct is arguably, coercive sex is arguably of the same genre as prostitution.
Perhaps arguably, Judge, but I would beg to differ. I think prostitution, certainly in light of what the Congress has done, is looking at some type of commercial transaction, something for hire. At one time it wasn't, but perhaps we just...
I'm talking about the Supreme Court's gloss, yes, that the Supreme Court put on it.
Yes.
Some say that nine older persons, I should say men, are not necessarily the best judges of the sexual mores of the country, but nonetheless, that's the instruction they put on it. And I'm just raising the question with you of
And the case is still there, and contrary to what the government has suggested, I don't have the fortitude to come and ask this court to overrule Biddy, and we haven't done that.
But that case is still there until the indictment, insofar as the adequacy of notice, that language is part of that indictment.
It is, and I think that this was a prosecution. I mean, you could foresee that we would be here today because of the way it wasn't.
But that pushes you then to instructional error.
As it said at the outset, I thought we would spend most of our time talking about instructional error.
Good. Well, then we're on the same page. That brings me back now to the question of what do you do with the Supreme Court's decision on multiple theories?
Well, and that's where we are, what I wanted to mention. Hedpeth versus Bellito is the 2008 decision that I believe my sister here is referring to. That's a standard of review case that basically said that it's not structural error if it's submitted on the wrong theory. I would suggest to you that Stromberg and Griffin still stand for the proposition that if there is a submission where one theory of guilt is unconstitutional, that in fact you have to go to a Chapman analysis, a harmless error analysis. And I want to point out something that I didn't point out earlier.
Well, I don't remember that. Did Scalia's opinion.
In which opinion?
Well,
in Griffin?
Scalia's original opinion, yes.
I just reviewed it this morning. I'm comfortable about that. He recognizes that Stromberg is still good law.
I'm sorry.
He recognizes that Stromberg is still good law in Griffin. The What I wanted to mention, we have misspoken in in my initial briefs to the extent that we used a Brecht analysis. The test here, the standard review for the submission, I think is for harmless error. I don't think that they've overcome it, but that we properly preserved our objections below. And so I think that what you will be looking for is whether or not under a Chapman Rule 52 analysis, the government was able to demonstrate that there was no harm. Obviously, we think that there was, because of the type of evidence that was introduced, the vast majority of which addressed circumstances that arose after the importation. My time's just expired. I thank the panel.
Thank you. Mr. Beard, your case is under submission. We'll now hear National Union.